This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Carolyn Quinn. Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour for Sunday, the 5th of November. 412 years ago today, the gunpowder plotters tried and failed to blow up the Houses of Parliament. Well, now it's explosive harassment allegations against Conservative, Labour and SNP legislators that are providing the political fireworks. Tonight, another story as well, a new leak of documents called the Paradise Papers, supplying revelations about how the powerful and wealthy around the world have secretly invested vast amounts of cash in offshore tax havens. Throw in a bit of Brexit as well and a look at the two candidates vying to become the Labour Party leader in Scotland. And there's plenty for my panel to ponder. They are Angela Smith, Labour's leader in the House of Lords, former MP for Basildon, who served as a minister under Gordon Brown. Kit Malthouse, the Conservative MP for North West Hampshire since 2015, former Deputy London Mayor under Boris Johnson, and he's a member of the Treasury Select Committee. And also here, Peter Hennessy, crossbench peer, historian, former journalist. He's written many books on post-war British governments, the inner workings of Whitehall, and in his own words, the hidden wiring of the British Constitution. So we will be delving into your mind to get some examples of where else we've seen the kind of crisis we're experiencing at the moment. And also here with us, David Wooding, political editor of The Sun on Sunday, who'll be guiding us through the coming week at Westminster. So welcome, everyone. And before we move on to matters regarding behaviour at Westminster, a quick word from our politicians here and from David about the revelations from the so-called Paradise Papers tonight. The BBC Panorama programme covered it. It's a huge new leak of financial documents revealing how the powerful and wealthy around the world, including the Queen's private estate, have invested vast amounts of cash in offshore tax havens. Kit Malthouse, Panorama suggested as well the Conservative Party donor Lord Ashcroft may have ignored rules about how his offshore investments were managed. How do you greet these stories? Because I remember Theresa May at the conference last year was saying, if you're a tax dodger, we're coming after you. Whoever you are, however rich or powerful, you have a duty to pay your tax. How does this sit with that?
Well, she's absolutely right. But of course, we have to bear in mind that I haven't seen anything so far that alleges anything that's illegal. And therein lies the nub of the problem, right? So it's
tax avoidance is not illegal.
Tax avoidance is not illegal. These people are perfectly at liberty to take advantage of these particular rules. But it's down to us as politicians internationally to try and sort this out. I mean, I've never quite understood why the great nations of the West and the big economies of Asia don't get together, frankly, to put the squeeze on and shut these offshore havens down. There has been a lot of work internationally, and you know, changes do come along every now and again. We've got some changes going through the finance bill at the moment to offshore taxation, particularly with regard to non-domiciles. But in truth, there's never been a kind of international decision that over time we're going to phase these out, and it may be time that we have to. But
well, you're on the Treasury Select Committee, aren't you? Is it something that you've discussed or would plan to discuss in future?
We have done. These revelations may mean that we do have a look at it again in the future. But yeah, there's quite a lot of British tax law, and I am, for my sins, a chartered accountant. Not that tax was my specialism, but there's quite a lot of British tax law which is specifically constructed to cope with offshore taxation, with offshore tax havens and offshore trusts and companies and funds and all the rest of it. So we acknowledge their existence and deal with them in British taxation regulation. And how much longer that can go on for, I don't know. Mm. It does say something about our own taxation system, though, that it has now become so complex and Byzantine, and everybody's talked about simplification, we never really seem to get there, that really, you know, while, you know, the revelations put the pressure, I guess, on the individuals who are taking part in these constructions, in truth, the pressure should be on the politicians to try and sort it out.
Angela Smith?
Well, that's right, isn't it? And Jeremy Corbyn raised this at Prime Minister's Questions just last week about concerns. I think there has been concern. The government's talked a lot about it, but we haven't really seen much change. And for most of us, when we see these sums of figures, those of us get a payslip that tells you how much you earn and how much tax you've paid, find this kind of, I don't know, organisations who avoid paying tax to be really appalling. And the figures are just eye-watering. I won't earn that money in my lifetime. And you've got people on a monthly basis trying to avoid paying tax. So those that have got the most are paying the least. And things with the less you have, the greater portion of your income you're paying in
tax.
But at
the moment, the law allows them.
Well, the law allows avoidance, but there may be things that are illegal in here. I just saw some of the clips of the programme before I came out, and they said the majority of this is perfectly legal. Well, I think we have to say, if the worst of this, and I don't know all the details, I'm not a tax expert, if the worst of it is legal, the law does have to be looked at. Jeremy Corbyn made the point, I think, on Wednesday about how many private jets there were on the Isle of Man, because it was you could get them in cheaply and tax one. Well, it's ridiculous, wasn't it? So I think clearly something has to be done. I think we'd like to see a proper tax enforcement unit. When the government, in the age of austerity, is cutting the number of staff that deal with these kind of issues, then clearly there's a problem. You should be actually increasing the staff dealing with this. It pays for itself.
Kit Malthouse and then David Whiting. Briefly,
yeah, I mean, the government has done a huge amount. I mean, I think they've raised, I think the figure was $160 billion. They've closed the tax
gap. There's a huge amount of discrepancy about that figure.
But you need to be careful. There's offshore and offshore, right? So the vast majority of people who might have a pension or a pension fund will find that they're invested in offshore funds. Quite a lot of funds are registered in Dublin. Does that count as offshore? Or in Luxembourg, does that count as offshore? So there are perfectly legitimate structures that do it. I guess the question that I'm posing is whether us, the United States, Japan, China, these large pools of capital shouldn't get together and be a bit more assertive internationally about making sure that we close some of these loopholes down.
Dave Whiting, this story now will probably unfold over the coming week, won't it?
Yes, it's a bit like the sleazy inquiry. I pity the journalists. There's 13.4 million documents to be scoured through, so there's quite a lot of stories to be unearthed in there. But I think that it's the strivers who are paying their taxes who will look at these wealthy people who are paying less tax. We talk about Amazon and coffee chains paying their dues. But we see in there that the Bright House, this company that was heavily criticised for charging exorbitant tax rates, interest rates to poor people who are buying a new television with 70% rates. And, of course, I think there might be some pressure on the royal family who've invested in the, I think it's £5 to £6 million, and that might increase the pressure for them to give full disclosure of their books to parliamentary scrutiny. Mm.
One to watch.
I thought the interesting part of the programme was that Michael Ashcroft seemed very reluctant to speak to the journalists. He was running away around the Conservative Party conference. And I think people who are named would be helpful if they gave us what they thought were the reasons they've done this.
He expressed his reasons for not commenting because he said Panorama had dealt
he
with
didn't
him
like Panorama.
In the past. Yeah. Now, we've had one cabinet minister, Sir Michael Fallon, going, another Damien Green, the Prime Minister's de facto deputy, seeing his career hanging by a thread as he faces claims that police found pornography on a computer during a raid on his House of Commons office 9 years ago. Damien Green accuses the former senior Met police officer Bob Quick of trying to smear him and strongly denies that pornography was found on his parliamentary computer. He was already facing calls from some colleagues to be suspended, while another allegation that he inappropriately touched a journalist's knee is under investigation. He denies that allegation. Now, this row, of course, part of the growing scandal of sexual harassment at Westminster. More MPs becoming embroiled, it seems, by the day. Tonight, the government whip, Chris Pincher, the latest he's referred himself to the police after accusations against him. At Westminster, both Conservatives and Labour and the SNP, to a degree, face allegations of failing to deal with complaints swiftly or, in some cases, apparently covering them up. The Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, told Andrew Marr on BBC One this morning that things have got to change.
Well, the Prime Minister has set out what she's going to do. She's going to work tomorrow across party with the party leaders to make sure a system is put in place. I think that there should be total candour about these sort of, if they're rumours or allegations, we need to bring them out, find out what's going on and deal with them in a transparent way so they don't happen again.
Amber Rudd referring there to a meeting tomorrow in which Theresa May and all the other party leaders are getting together hoping to agree a common independent grievance procedure for tackling complaints of harassment. The pressure's built on Labour as well, of course, including the suspension of the MP Kelvin Hopkins over allegations of inappropriate conduct. And most shockingly, after the activist Bex Bailey told me here on Radio 4 that she'd been raped at a party event in 2011 and felt discouraged to report it as it could have damaged her career. Well, Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader this evening, said it's not enough to say this is wrong and then only tinker with procedures.
Labour is committed not just to challenging a warped and degrading culture in Westminster and across society, but to overturning it. This week, we appointed a leading barrister to investigate if and how the party got it so painfully wrong in the case of Bex Bailey. We are not afraid to turn the spotlight on ourselves.
Peter Hennessy, do you feel another morality tale unfolding at Westminster? I mean, you know, one that's really grimly familiar, it has to be said. You know, back to basics under John Major, cash questions.
They all come back in the memory, don't they?
Expenses.
But the magnitude of this one, as indeed the litany that, Caroline, that you just had to go through to explain the story, shows that it's on a grander scale this time. And it's very depressing and alarming. But the back to basics one is still very live in many people's memories. And each time it erupts, this question, there's a sort of sociological and physiological explanation that people come up with. It's a combination of libido, opportunity and liquor. And it seems that the premises of the Houses of Parliament lend themselves to this. And it's very difficult to know what to do about it. But the good will come out of this one, I think, because all three party leaders are signed up to doing something about this. But the question that intrigues me is this time, will it lead to an independent body that does all these complaints, or will each party have their own apparatus? And that could be a very interesting question. In which system will the public have more confidence? Mm. And the worrying thing about this too, quite apart from the terrible nature of some of the cases, though there's a spectrum here that I've not gone on the website and looked at all of it. I've just heard from some people what it's like. Some of it is entirely their personal business. Other allegations are very, very serious indeed. And this is at a time when Parliament does need more than the usual level of trust it gets from the country because of the magnitude of the questions that we're facing. No doubt we'll come on to Brexit in a minute. So it's deeply unfortunate, the timing of it, but at the same time, it is much better that these things come out and are dealt with than not. But back to basics was fascinating because we remember reporting it. John Major didn't mean it to be about morality at all. He meant it to be about neighbourliness, education, social care. And I think it was a young person in central office who briefed the hacks to the fact that this was all about morality. And then it took off in that direction. It was absolutely irretrievable. And I remember John Major in an interview I did with him for Radio 4, I think 2 or 3 years ago, saying it was distorted. He felt so passionately that the memory of it was very vivid for him. He felt you could see the scar of it because it was a sensible approach, he thought, and indeed many people would have agreed, which took on a distortion, as he would have put it. And it was at the period when that government was on the ropes. It was a weak government by then, and the press, he thought, was rampant. So there's a certain echo with today's condition of the Conservative Party, lacking confidence as it does on so many fronts.
Well, Kit Moorhouse, I mean, an already fragile Prime Minister without authority, a very, very small majority. I mean, looking back to John Major, it was glorious for him compared to now. He had a majority of 21, didn't he, in the early 90s? A domination of Brexit. Not much money around. You know, how much longer do you think this can go on? What depth of trouble is the government in? And I will address this to Labour as well.
Well, it depends how it turns out, right? So there's innocent till proven guilty. We need to have due process. And although we've seen one cabinet minister go, we've yet to find out what the conclusion of some of these other complaints are. I mean, I guess the question is where we go from here. Obviously, the party has published a code of conduct. There's now a system to deal with complaints pending the meeting this week and hopefully an agreement between the parties. But I do think it's obviously something that affects all the parties, and there's a structural problem, I think. I don't just think it's about your three, Peter. I think there's a structural problem, which is that I employ my staff. I'm lucky enough to have a brilliant team of three who look after me, but I am directly their employer. And I've been in politics for a long time now, but I've never had that before. And I think that structure creates a particular conflict in that they don't have anywhere to go other than to me as their employer. And it also creates a kind of jeopardy situation where their job is on the line. Mm. So for me, I think it would be more sensible if MP's staff were direct employees of the House. I mean, they're paid by the House. The House dictates what their contracts say. They broadly say what their rates of pay are. But yet, legally, I'm the employer. And I think that's a structural problem that we could solve quite easily. It would also mean that people could move around more easily in the House and have more of a kind of career that they could build in the building rather than kind of being stuck with one MP.
All right, we'll get on to the procedures that have been set up by the parties and perhaps Westminster-wide in a moment. But there are questions about about how much the whips knew about some of these allegations, how much they were guarding these allegations to themselves in a way of holding influence over MPs. I mean, you know, we've heard that before. There's no reason to think that wasn't happening now, is there?
Well, I have to say, I don't know. I've never been in the whip's office. I've never really had very much to do with them, other than being told where to go and what to do. But Amber Rudd was on the television this morning, and she did do a year in the whip's office, and she denied the fact that there was any black book. Certainly when I came into
Maybe
the house...
Maybe not now.
Well, certainly when I came into the house, it became very clear, actually, that the whip's office was perhaps pivoting towards much more of a kind of pastoral care role, because, you know, it can be quite a challenging existence being a Member of Parliament, and that there was much more of a sense that they had to kind of look after us and deal with any concerns and worries that might come through. But I can't speak for previous generations.
No.
I mean, the whole experience has been horrible for everybody, and in truth, you know, we need a proper structure that allows both accuser and accused to make their complaint in an atmosphere of confidentiality but also transparency if it's needed. Because otherwise, right, we end up, and forgive me, David, we end up with what's happened this week, which is trial by newspaper, both for victim and for accused.
Angela, Labour and the Conservatives have set out a new code. Labour's setting up an independent organisation to which people can go if they need advice on how to proceed if they've been a victim of any sort of harassment, or in Bex Bailey's case, you know, serious assault. She was raped. Why has it taken so long to do this? Because she told me that she's been calling for these tougher procedures from the Labour Party for years. She's been asking for this as a member of the NEC, and so far she's been rebuffed. Now it's happening.
Yeah, I can't understand why she'd have been rebuffed. It seems to me it's common sense to have such procedures in place, and I don't suppose people realise why she was asking, but her personal experience has made her a champion on these issues. And I heard your interview with her, and I must admit, the emotions rage quite widely. You sort of feel tears spring to your eyes, you feel anger, you're horrified. I don't think that feeling's left most of us. You know, I think for most people, working for an MP is a great experience. You know, I spent 2 years working for an MP. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I enjoyed working in Parliament, and I became an MP myself, and I hope I was a good employer. But nobody in their place of work, and quite often, when we see in some of the stories we're hearing, the person they're complaining about isn't their direct employer, their MP, it's somebody else. One of the things that struck me was, I think it was Michael Fallon, apologies if it wasn't, but said, what was acceptable 10, 15 years ago isn't acceptable today. Well, society does move on, society changes, and we've made progress, but it really never, ever was acceptable to abuse somebody sexually, physically, bullying, intimidating at work. That was never, ever acceptable. And I think the number of things Parliament has to do, and the political parties have to do, there has to be a supportive process that has to be used. No point in having the greatest processes in the world if no one uses them, that is has an independence to it and has the confidence of those who want to report any abuse. And the worrying thing is, and I think we saw this in one of the cases this week, somebody didn't report something at the time because they thought theirs was an isolated case. Mm. But when two or three people report something, then you realise there's a pattern of behaviour. And I think it's that pattern of behaviour from some people, and it may be very few, it doesn't matter how many it is, but if there's a pattern of behaviour that is abusive towards those you are in a position of power over. And I think that's one of the key things here. There are some people in Parliament who have positions of authority and power, and if they use that to in any way abuse anybody else, be it a member of their staff or a member of somebody else's staff, that is really totally unacceptable. But all criminal matters, I think, must be reported to the police. There can't be in a way of avoiding criminal prosecutions if an action taken is criminal.
Dave Wooding, this meeting tomorrow of all the leaders at Westminster, and we have to make the point that it's not just within the walls of Parliament that this is happening, but it's happening across political parties, you know, across councils, activists as well. But the meeting at Westminster, what do you think we can expect to hear tomorrow?
Well, there is clearly a determination to do something. And part of this, Angela was just talking about what wasn't acceptable 10, 20 years ago. Correct. What's changed, I think, is the direction of the wind. There is a new mood internationally. Weinstein crisis has affected Parliament, and one or two come forward, and people have got the confidence and that they will be listened to now. And in the same way, I think the party leaders believe they have to do something. So there will be a real determination to do it.
What is this independent grievance organisation? I think part of the problem is
if something goes wrong at our place, you know, you have a trade union leader or you have a head of department or somebody you can go to. In the cases of these people, as Kit was saying earlier, some of the researchers, their boss is sometimes the person who is misbehaving. So some kind of way they can whistleblow without having to come to us. At the moment, the only way they can get their story out there is via the media, unfortunately.
And Peter, there will be an equivalent meeting, I'm told, in the Lords to discuss the way forward as well. But as you know, there have been moments in the past where this is the moment for change. This is the pivotal moment. Do you fear that this may not be the turning point if we base it on past experience when we've been equally horrified at events?
I think because of the numbers involved and the genuine shock, I don't think this is a quick shock that will go. I think the percussive effect of what we've seen in the last 10 days will go on for a very long time. So I don't think this is one of those occasions when it will go into the limbo of long-forgotten things, which has happened in the past.
But perhaps Parliament can set a gold standard, because I've talked to friends in other areas of work where they've faced problems as well and they haven't spoken up. Perhaps if Parliament speaks up, Parliament does something that is positive, that can make a difference, then that should encourage other employers as well.
Just moving on to something else that is happening this week. We have the CBI conference taking place tomorrow. Now, the Prime Minister and Jeremy Corbyn will both be making speeches there. But Carolyn Fairbairn, the Director General of the CBI, told me earlier that the biggest concern for business remains, for the moment, Brexit.
This is an extraordinarily important time now for the Brexit negotiations, that run up to Christmas where businesses really need more certainty and more clarity. And the reason why it's become so urgent is that we're now in the window of decision making. So we've just done a survey which shows that 60% of firms will have taken steps to implement contingency plans by the end of next March. Now that's real jobs, real people, a real implication for our economy. So the message, I think, from us, from business, is more certainty quickly, particularly around transition and particularly in the next 4 weeks.
And if you get signs of a transition agreement in place within the next 3 months, say, would firms pause their contingency plans?
Well, we think they would. We asked the question directly, and three quarters of larger firms have said that a transition deal would lead them to put their contingency plans on pause. So that's a really powerful message that I think is saying, let's have unity around a single clear strategy, let's have clarity as soon as possible, and we can keep jobs and investment in the UK.
You're looking at an urgent transition agreement. Do you have confidence that that might happen? There's another round of Brexit talks coming at the end of this week. Do you feel any sense of progress towards what you want?
There has been progress, but I still think that there is a lot more to be done between now and December to get it right. So the Florence speech the Prime Minister made was the right vision. It had transition, it had a sense of collaboration with Europe, but we now need unity behind it. We need the European Union to see things in the same way, and we are doing a lot on that front. And then I think it can be done.
Obviously, there's quite a lot happening around the Prime Minister at the moment. Do you think that perhaps Brexit might have to take a side position, that they might have to be pushed off to one side for a moment while the Prime Minister deals with all these other problems on her plate?
We might want to slow the clock down, but that's not going to happen. Brexit has to stay centre stage. There is so much riding on it. Businesses need to know what's happening, otherwise they will take decisions. So I'm afraid there's going to have to be a way found to do the Brexit negotiations well in parallel with, yes, the other challenges on her plate. Too much rides on it.
And worst case scenario then, how many jobs do you think could move out of the UK if you don't get this transition deal quickly?
Well, we haven't estimated that number, but I think that we can tell from the way firms are talking and planning and heading into this that it could be significant. There are some sectors that I think are particularly effective, for example, automotive and pharmaceuticals. Food and drink are beginning to examine their options. So I think the impact undoubtedly is significant, but it can be prevented. It can be prevented. And transition is a very important step along the way. Then getting the shape of the final deal early next year is the next very important step.
Well, Kit Malthouse, you're on the Treasury Committee. You're in favour of Brexit.
Yep.
I saw you shaking your head during that. Are you absolutely confident then that there will be the sort of transition deal that Caroline Fairbairn was talking about, mirroring existing arrangements, without which she feels that jobs could be lost?
I am relatively confident about it, although the CBI shouldn't pretend that they need to be passive in this, right? These are vast organisations that they represent, some of them bigger than nations. They have armies of lobbyists and influencers who spend a lot of time pestering us in Westminster, and as far as I can see, they should be mobilising to do the same on the continent. The government has made it clear that they want a transition agreement. They've made it clear that they want to move towards talking about the terms of trade. It's the EU, to a certain extent, who are being slow on this stuff. And if I were these vast organisations, I would be sending these people, as I say, to Brussels and Strasbourg and the capitals and the chancelleries of Europe to lobby for this. I know I'm chairman of the All-Party Life Sciences Group, and I know that in particular the life sciences industry is starting to do that now, but it's getting to a sort of time when really they need to step up.
She was making the point, though, Angela, wasn't she, about the need for some sort of certainty, and there's a limited time frame now. Are you confident that that will come?
Well, I agree with Karen Fairbairn. I can understand she's worried, and I find Kit's response there absolutely extraordinary. Ain't me, Gov, it ain't our fault, almost.
Now, the government, that's not what I said.
Well, it's how it came across, Kit, that it should be the CBI should be out there negotiating.
They should join the coalition that's trying to get movement on Europe towards our position.
But I mean,
we can only do what we can do.
The
government
responds,
said they want a transition.
Yeah, you can only... only do what we can do. It's actually the government has taken on this responsibility to negotiate the Brexit deal. And business does need certainty, and I don't think they're being unsupportive. This is an opportunity for the government to work with the CBI, and it's extraordinary that the CBI and all the other business organisations are criticising the government. But if you think about it, when the Prime Minister spoke in Florence, in that Florence speech, I'm never quite sure why it was in Florence, but in that Florence speech, she was clear that she wanted transitional arrangements on current terms. By the time she got to the House of Commons the following week, that had changed and she wasn't saying on current terms. And that's what I think gives business difficulty. If there isn't a transitional deal in place, then the economy really falls off a cliff edge. And why they need certainty and early on is because they are making investment decisions now that affects jobs in this country.
Well, Dave Wooding, we have round six of the Davis-Barnier talks, don't we, coming up this week. So perhaps there could be progress there?
Yeah, there was some suggestion in the Sunday papers this morning that a deal on trade will be reached by the end of the year. And in fact, as you were talking about the CBI, Theresa May will be talking to the CBI tomorrow. And in extracts of the speech, which I think we've just passed the embargo, so we're safe to talk about it, she'll be saying that industry should grasp these huge opportunities, invest in skills and infrastructure, and broaden the economic base to get out there and make Brexit work. So, yeah, we are starting to hear, I think, a little bit more of the positive sides of Brexit, which is a great change.
Peter, you were making the point, though, that with these allegations about harassment and the events at Westminster happening, they're happening at a moment when the public want to be able to trust politicians and the government to smoothly work their way through Brexit.
Everybody's got to raise the level of their game on this Brexit negotiation because we've not faced anything like it before. I mean, disposing of the British Empire was relatively easy compared to this geopolitical shift. And there's only so much a finite amount of nervous energy and time you can deploy. And so anything that distracts from it. But I was very interested in Caroline Fairbairn's use of words, the window of decision-taking, because I was talking to one of the old toughies, the old Whitehall toughie, about this the other day. And he said, when it's at the commission stage, this negotiation, it's very largely formation dancing. And the serious decisions will only take place right at the end when the big heads of government do it, Macron, Merkel and Mrs. May. And as another friend of mine put it, that's when the serious political choreography takes place. But the problem with that is, in the nature of the negotiation, you've got to pave the granular details very carefully on the road to that final choreography. I'm mixing metaphors here, madly. And it's going, it's going to be very difficult to do that. And I think it's very interesting, the negotiations this week. If there's not a quickening of pace, which we'll know about by the end of the week, then it really is very worrying indeed. But I'm sure my old mate is quite right. There is an element of formation dancing at the Commission level and a great deal of schadenfreude on behalf of certain people in Europe. And in many ways, it's out of central casting, isn't it? This sleek product of the École Nationale d'Administration, Michel Barnier, and the sort of comic wingman in Juncker. It's made for parody, and the newspapers won't be able to resist that. And good, tough, straightforward Brits who want no nonsense are doing their best, but in very difficult circumstances. It's all too serious, actually. I shouldn't make light of any of it, because it's deeply anxiety-inducing. And if we get this one wrong, the consequences are going to be very profound.
And Dave Wooding, the EU withdrawal bill starts its committee stage on November the 14th, doesn't it? Which is after there's been a small Commons recess this week.
And there's all the fear among the Brexiteers that the Remainers are going to throw all these amendments in to try and derail the bill. Remainers all saying, no, no, honest gov, we're trying to get the very best we can in the deal. And it's difficult with these two sides polarised to know exactly where it is. And of course, a lot of the ordinary people out there just saying, get on with it, get this thing
400 done. 400 amendments, Kit Malthouse. Are you going to be able to cope with those?
Do
you
think there'll be some long nights, long and
that'll
difficult
nights? That'll be a novelty at the moment.
I mean, it will be to a certain extent. I mean, look, each of them, we've got, I think it's, is it 8 days? Eight protects, so 64 hours of debate, and it might run longer.
It'll run longer.
Two, I think it will. Look, I think...
What about when it gets up to the Lord's end?
Well, who knows? They can speak for themselves. But can I just say, I think Peter's absolutely right about the negotiation. If you'd asked me 2 years ago or 500 days ago when the referendum was to map out the timetable, we would broadly be where I would have expected us to be, not least because what you say about the elected heads in Europe is true. And, of course, we had a French and a German election to get through that have delayed things somewhat. I think I don't know whether Angela Merkel's yet got a coalition government put together.
It's proving very difficult.
That would have delayed things. And we have seen straws in the wind, as David said, about some movement. But there's fundamentally this problem, right, which is that they want to know what we're going to pay and we want to know what we're going to buy. And until those two come together, there isn't really going to be that much progress. They said at the start, if you remember, nothing's agreed till everything's agreed. Well, you can't agree anything if you're not going to discuss everything.
All right. If we're talking money, very briefly, Dave, we have a budget coming up on the 22nd of November. Now, obviously, attention is diverted elsewhere, but we're hearing that there's still a bit of a row within the Cabinet over how to approach issues like housing. Do you bung a load of money at it? Do you build on the green belt? There are disagreements between Philip Hammond and Theresa May.
Yes, on the one hand, Theresa May wants to build houses. She thinks we need to build more houses, not because we need, only because we need to house people, but because young people can't afford to buy them. And one of the reasons the Conservatives did so poorly in the election was because young people were turning to Jeremy Corbyn. They felt they saw no hope in Conservative policies. So a lot of young people friendly policies in there. By contrast, Philip Hammond wants to do more about reforming. He said, we've got all the builders here ready to build the houses, but there's nowhere to build them. There is no places where we can stick these houses up. So it's a mixture. I think they're coming to an agreement of a mixture of money, planning reform, but there will be a fuss, particularly in the Daily Telegraph, I guess.
Over green belts.
Yeah.
In a word, will it be greenbelt or not? You're on the Treasury Committee, Kit.
It depends what you mean by greenbelt. I mean, I have a beautiful...
Oh, don't complicate things.
I have a beautiful constituency in northwest Hampshire. It's rolling downs and the rest of it. And I'm going to take something like 25,000 houses in my constituency over the next 20 years. So there's places that houses can go. There's lots of space for them. The question is how you enable and you accelerate the house building. And I think that's what the debate will be about.
Greenbelt, Peter and Angela?
Absolutely, greenbelt. If we hadn't had the greenbelt after the war, which everybody signed up to in British politics in the front benches, we would have a city that runs from London to Oxford It would just be ribbon development right down the main roads, all of them. And the southeast of England would be hideous. And also it would be hideous in the big cities in the north and the Midlands too. So don't let's forget, it was one of the great, great things of the post-war years when we were an altruistic nation.
Great things of a Labour government in the post-war years.
I knew you were going to say that.
I couldn't resist. But if you look at what that government did in terms of building homes for people, I think there's the thing about, particularly about Green Belt, if you keep the same amount of Green Belt in an area, now I can identify areas of Green Belt in my former patch where actually they weren't green or attractive or nice, but you could have replaced those with other areas that were open space that people would get pleasure out of. So let's balance it. As long as we have the same amount of green area that people can enjoy.
The budget coming up. Do you realise it's almost a year since Donald Trump entered the White House?
It was a lot longer.
There is another election going on, the race to become leader of the Scottish Labour Party. It's entering its final straight. It began last August with the sudden resignation of Kezia Dugdale. Contenders MSPs Anna Sawar and Richard Leonard find out on November the 18th which of them will be successful. Whoever wins, of course, will become the party's ninth leader since devolution in Scotland 18 years ago. Both have stressed their ambition to be the next First Minister of Scotland, even though Labour's been trailing the SNP and Conservatives in the polls. If Labour fortunes revive north of the border, could this help propel Jeremy Corbyn towards Downing Street? John Beasley reports from the campaign trail.
Outside, it's dull and wet, but there's an upbeat mood inside the hall in Glenrothes at this gathering of women members of the Scottish TUC.
Where school are you all from?
St Columbus.
St Columbus. Thank you. And you're here for the film day?
Anna Sawar is meeting school students visiting the conference. He's been campaigning on the theme of a Scotland where no one is left behind.
Some of the policies that we've outlined in this contest is, one, how we protect jobs and trade, and I believe we only do that if we retain permanent membership of the single market and the customs union. Yeah, talking about the Scottish Child Tax Credit policy that would target support to the poorest families and would help lift 50,000 children out of poverty. And also talking about progressive taxation. Now that we have the tax problems in Scotland, we should introduce a genuinely progressive and redistributive tax system. And that's why I want to give a tax cut to the bottom 50% of workers and a significant tax increase to the top 2%.
Anna Sawar used to be an MP at Westminster until the SNP's landslide of 2015 swept away all but one of Labour's seats. Last year, things looked even bleaker for the party when the Conservatives, once moribund in Scotland, pushed Labour into third place in the Scottish Parliament. But in June this year, signs of a modest Labour revival, regaining six seats at Westminster from the Scottish National Party. So has Labour turned the corner? John Curtis is Professor of Politics at Strathclyde University and a leading polling expert.
There is no doubt it's still in a difficult place. It's still only got seven MPs north of the border. It still came third to the Conservatives in the June election. But actually, the position did show some signs of turning around. Certainly, Jeremy Corbyn's ability to appeal to young voters was in evidence late in the campaign north of the border. And it's certainly amongst that group, amongst whom Labour Party north of the border primarily made progress.
And Labour's appeal could have been wider still, according to MSP Richard Leonard, a trade union activist originally from Yorkshire. He's campaigning for the leadership on a platform which includes house building, a wealth tax, raising child benefit for all, and bringing trains and buses into public ownership.
The issue for us in Scotland was, in the general election, we didn't talk about public ownership. We didn't talk about that radical redistribution of wealth and power. We didn't talk about our strong plans to end austerity. We just talked about the Scottish constitutional question. And that, in my view, is one of the reasons why we failed to pick up the level of support that we ought to have done. So my prospectus is, let's get talking again about those radical policies. They will appeal to people.
Richard Leonard is by no means the only one in Scottish Labour who would like to get away from talking about the Constitution. They see it as an issue which has helped the SNP. But Professor John Curtis believes it's something that's difficult to avoid if Labour is to set out a compelling vision for the future.
The truth is, the big question the Labour Party has never really answered in Scotland in the near 20 years of devolution is really to lay out a vision of the kind of Scotland it would want to create using the powers of devolution, and in what ways indeed public services and the other aspects of life in Scotland would indeed improve under a Labour government. The narrative of the kind of Scotland the Scottish Labour Party want to create is, in my view, still missing and has never really been written ever since the advent of devolution.
So how does Anna Sawa respond?
The sad reality of Scottish politics at the moment is you don't get the right to be listened to on other issues unless people know where you stand on the constitution. So I'm clear, I want to stay in the United Kingdom, I want to strengthen Scotland's place in the United Kingdom, and now that we've made that clear, let's talk about how we end child poverty, let's talk about how we end the gender pay gap.
Both candidates have made reducing inequality a theme of their leadership bids. But whether Scottish Labour retains the ability to campaign as effectively as it once did is open to question. Dr. Jerry Hassan is a writer, academic and commentator on Scottish politics. He told me that having run Scotland for 50 years, the Labour Party still sees themselves as political insiders, whereas they should, he says, be fighting as outsiders, insurgents, against an establishment now run by the SNP.
There isn't a hunger about wanting to bring change in Scotland. There isn't a hunger about wanting to campaign. There isn't insights into like how you do policy and politics when you don't have the system to rely on backup. This is a party that for 50 years relied on the Scottish state, local government and trade unions to how it did politics. And it hasn't adapted on any level to how it does politics without those supports. So that's what I mean by insurgency comes with the fact of as an outsider, you have to, you know, do it yourself, basically. So on so many levels, they don't know how to do that.
So how much attention is the public paying to this campaign? A few miles down the Fife coast from Glenrothes is one of the brighter spots for Labour in Scotland. For many years, the Westminster constituency of Kirkcaldy and Cowdenbeath was represented by Gordon Brown with thumping majorities. But when the former Prime Minister stood down in 2015, even this Labour bastion was not safe from the SNP juggernaut, which took 56 of the 59 parliamentary seats north of the border. Well, in 2017, Labour snatched this seat back from the SNP. So what do people here now make of the contest going on inside the party to lead it?
I'm interested. Who leads the Labour Party. I really thought Gordon Brown was making a good job of it. And I think if the left Corbyn today's bit, he would make a good job as well.
I'm not really interested in it at all, doesn't he?
I don't know who you're talking about.
I think the politics are all fighting against each other and they'll promise you everything but do nothing.
And SNP.
You support the SNP? Did you used to support Gordon Brown, though, when he was here?
Yeah.
So why did you change?
Because of it just went out of heck. I had no interest. At one time, it was for the working class, but it's no new.
Very interested. I hope they get in. I've always thought they were for the working class.
And do you know who the two candidates are for the leadership?
I have heard of them, but I can't remember the name.
Not that this vote depends on the wider public. It's Scottish Labour members and registered supporters who'll decide. And while Jeremy Corbyn has attracted huge numbers into the party in England, Jerry Hassan says that in Scotland, the membership remains small.
It's a tiny electorate that decide this election, a maximum of 30,000 people. So both candidates, Richard Leonard and Anna Sawa, have gone out of their way to sign up as many members as possible, which the rules allow. So Unite have signed up several thousand members to vote, and Anna Sawa has carefully worked the area of Glasgow that he is most well known in, Glasgow Southside. And the membership of that has, you know, absolutely bulged. Now, in a close contest, which this could be, that could be the decisive factor, who signs up most members. So it's really the most old-fashioned Tammany Hall kind of politics that could decide this election.
That report there from John Beazley on the Scottish Labour leadership contest. And Angela, do either of these candidates have the passion or the vision, do you think, to take on Nicola Sturgeon or Ruth Davidson?
Yeah, I think they've both got the passion and the commitment, to be honest. And it is a challenging time. You know, don't underestimate how hard we were hit when we lost those seats in Scotland. And Ian Murray, I think we were very lucky. Ian Murray was one MP and he really was excellent, did a fantastic job. But I think for the new leader coming in, it's a challenging time. It's also quite an exciting time. Having won back, you know, six of the seats at the last general election, within sort of spitting distance, as it were, of a number of others. You know, I think that, you know, we're looking forward to sort of taking on that challenge. And so I think they're both up for it. I think they're both being in teams of people that want to work with them. So I say, I think it's a challenging time. It's also quite exciting as well.
And Kit Malthouse, you can't risk losing any seats to a revived Labour Party in Scotland, because those 13 Conservative MPs that Ruth Davidson has given to Westminster, well, 12 plus her, are crucial to Theresa May.
Yeah, but it doesn't look as if that's likely. I mean, the big mo is with Ruth, right? She's got the momentum and certainly seems to have the pizzazz and charisma that's taken us from nowhere to being a significant force in Scottish politics again. I mean, I have to confess.
Perhaps you should be your party leader.
Sorry?
Perhaps you should be your party
leader.
Well,
a lot of people are talking about that in the papers. I don't know. She said she's very committed to Scotland and that she wants to be First Minister of Scotland. I think that's a fine ambition for her.
As do the two candidates vying for the Labour leadership. And what about you, Peter, watching this? I mean, here we have another leader possibly in Scotland after devolution.
It's extraordinary, because I grew up in the days of Willie Ross, who was as permanent and granitic as Edinburgh Castle. I don't know how long he was leader of the Scottish Labour Party. But of course, Labour for years until 2010 or till 2015 was the golden dollar reserves in terms of seats for the Labour Party. It went down from 41 out of 59 to 1 and then came up to 7. But to get back to anywhere near its hegemony, I think, well, to be honest, we'll take the second coming.
No, I'm a little bit more optimistic than you are, Peter.
Let's see the result. Let's see the result of this leadership race. Anyway, now David Wooding is back and you've got the front pages there in front of you. What have we got?
Well, we were talking about the papers, the leaks of all these offshore tax havens. And we mentioned the Queen earlier. Well, she's made the front pages of four papers. Queen dragged into 10 million offshore tax row, screams the Daily Mail. And she's also on the front page of the Daily Mirror. Tax haven scandal, they call it. The Guardian and the Times. So that's, as we predicted, a big story in most of the papers this morning.
And more revelations, we're told, throughout the week.
Yep.
Otherwise, though, the harassment issue and the situation at Westminster hasn't gone away in any way, has it?
Yes, well, the Sun is splashing on Damian Green. They have an exclusive from Mike Sullivan, the crime reporter, which says that the pornography allegedly found on the First Secretary of State's computer was extreme enough for police to ask the Crown Prosecution Service to decide whether or not to charge him.
Now, of course, he denies the allegations, yes, about the computer. But Kit Malthouse, do you think that he should step aside or be suspended while the inquiry into him continues? That's certainly what Anna Soubry and some others in your party are saying should happen.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on his particular situation. It's for him and the Prime Minister to decide what he should do during this inquiry. And I think this is part of the issue that I talked about earlier, right? I think this trial by newspaper, rather than due process, is tricky for all concerned.
Well, it's newspaper stories prompted by certain events at Westminster. I mean, Angela, Labour and Tories, we said, have set out new codes. Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, has said that there should be the removal from Parliament, perhaps, of MPs found guilty of sexual harassment as part of an overhaul of anti-harassment procedures at Westminster. Would you welcome that?
Yeah, I was surprised she said that, because I think the last thing the Conservative Party wants at the moment, when he by-elections, and I hope that doesn't enter into how these issues are dealt with by any party.
Not just the Conservatives, of course.
No, but Amber Rudd saying it about party. I can't see the Conservative Party wanting by-elections, but certainly the same criteria, the same rules should apply across the board. This isn't a party political issue, and I think any party who tries to make that sort of political capital won't have any support from the public. But yeah, really, in any other place of work, people normally stand aside or they're away from the place of work while investigations take place. And if Parliament's going to set a gold standard, it's going to have to look at doing these things properly.
Can I say a little something about trial by newspaper? I know it may be felt unfair for the defendant in this case, but it's also unfair for the prosecution, if that's what newspapers are. Because what readers don't often see is the information that newspapers have, which they're not allowed to publish for legal reasons. We get heavy-handed lawyers' letters. We have stuff that we don't print because of various legal reasons, proof, evidence, privacy laws, Leveson, all the other regulations and the code of conduct. So often these things I'm not talking about Damien Green particularly, I'm talking generally, there's a lot more that we know about which are not there in the public arena.
Is it also the case, David, often, unless somebody's named, other victims don't come forward? Yes. It's a really difficult area, this, for lawyers dealing with it as well.
I don't blame the press particularly. I think you're doing the job that you need to do, but I'm just saying that's in the absence of a proper structured process.
20 more seconds, David, of headlines.
Well, yes, there's a nice picture of Donald Trump in his flying jacket in the Telegraph, but the one that caught my eye was the Times at the top. The doctor will see you now. The NHS starts the smartphone revolution. So it means that NHS patients will be able to jump the queue. Instead of queuing at the doctor for an appointment or ringing in endlessly, you can go through on your smartphone and you can see his face on the phone, or her face.
The virtual GP will
see you now. But there's a problem that maybe that the older people who don't use phones may end up not being able to use it.
Thank you, David Wooding, Angela Smith, Kit Malthouse, Peter Hennessy. We're back at the same time next week. For now, from all of us here on the Westminster Hour, good night.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.